You are listening to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit us at lfla.org.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to Aloud. I'm Jessica Strand, the director of programs at the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. The Library Foundation of Los Angeles is instrumental in supporting many programs at the Los Angeles Public Library, from homework help to college prep to Read Baby Read. The list is long, and the programs are vital in giving access and help to Angelenos across this vast city. This season, as I've discussed before, we are focusing on resilience. We picked this idea for many reasons. Most importantly, it spoke to now and how all of us had to be resilient in order to survive these last 20 months. We've adjusted our daily lives in order to deal with the constant challenges, frustrations, and acute realities that we've all had to face. The discrepancies and attitudes that were ingrained in the American psyche for so long were awakened as we were forced to look at ourselves and our country as we collectively faced our fears. Issues that always were part of our history came to light more clearly than ever. One of the of those realities was the deep racial divide that exists in America. Protests and marches made many of us want to learn and understand more about why our nation is so fragmented. Tonight, we're going to look at the matter of Black Lives, a collection of writing from the New Yorker magazine. The anthology includes essays of James Baldwin, Zadie Smith, Toni Morrison, Hilton Owls, Henry Louis Gates Jr., and many others. As Jelani Cobb, the anthology's editor, puts it so aptly, quote, "This is not an anthology about race. It is a collection about a broad, fascinating set of events and the people who are most commonly tasked with confronting it. The American future is precisely as bright or as dark as our capacity to grapple with this enduring concern. This collection is a chronicle of at least a part of our past and a lens to help envision a better American future." Jelani Cobb is a journalist and historian. He is the professor of journalism at Columbia University, as well as being a staff writer for The New Yorker. He's a recipient of the Hillman Award for Opinion and Analysis and the recipient of the fellowships from the Ford and Fulbright Foundations. He'll be in conversation tonight with Charlene Hunter-Gault, who is a journalist with more than 50 years experience as a correspondent and contributor to NBC, PBS, NPR, The New York Times, and The New Yorker. She is the author of four nonfiction books, as well as the upcoming My People, which will be published in 2022. Hunter-Gault has earned many awards, including Emmys, Peabody Awards, and the Black Enterprise Legacy Award. Along with her numerous accomplishments, she is and was the first Black staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. It is my privilege to introduce Jelani Cobb and Charlene Hunter-Gault. Thank you both so much for being here. Thank you.
Thank you, Jessica.
You're very welcome.
Charlene, how are you?
Hi, Jelani, and hi to Jessica and everybody on joining us. It's wonderful to be with you again.
Yeah, it's good to talk to you. You know, it's interesting because, you know, we always have this conversation like, oh, what are we going to talk about? You know, but then, you know, we wind up talking and then, you know, at the end they have to give us, you know, the hook to get us off, you know, the screen. So I'll start with you and say, you know, we have this collection and, you know, I know what I want to start with. You know, we put together this collection in under very particular circumstances, you know, in the aftermath of George Floyd's death, as there was discord and anger in streets, literally thousands of streets across the country. And you know, we were looking for work that could be instructive and insightful, you know, for people. And I think one of the best decisions that the New Yorker editors made was to republish James Baldwin's essay, "A Letter from a Region of My Mind," on the website. And, you know, for people who've read that essay, you know, they, you know how important it is. But very many people have read that essay without knowing it because, you know, the book, The Fire Next Time, is essentially that essay. That essay is about 85% of The Fire Next Time. And so we start thinking after that about the nature of, you know, what Baldwin was talking about and the ways in which it has been, you know, reflected in the pages of The New Yorker. And really in 1962, when that essay ran, that was the first time The New Yorker had dealt with anything explicitly racial in that way in its history. And it was founded in 1925. And, you know, early on, there was just really nothing and, you know, not anything from Black contributors and certainly not anything that explicitly dealt with race in that way. You know, with the exception of Rebecca West's, you know, piece in Opera in Greenville, which was about a lynching in South Carolina. But, you know, getting back to the point, what's really interesting to me is the two things that happen in close proximity, you know, which is one, you know, Baldwin writing this concussive essay and giving it to William Shawn to run in The New Yorker, and your appearance as the first Black staff writer at The New Yorker. And I wonder, I never tire of hearing that story of how that came about. And I wonder if you could just talk about that tonight.
About how I came to be at The New Yorker?
How you came to be at The New Yorker, and also secondarily, how that piece that you wrote, the one that, but the first piece that you ever wrote for The New Yorker, how that came about, because it connects to this as well.
Oh, I see. Well, you know, you've heard a little bit about my own background and my sensitivity to race. Although I didn't start out to be a Black journalist, I started out to be a journalist. Mm-hmm. But you don't ever leave who you are if you are honest with yourself. Mm-hmm. And so I have used myself, a Black person, a woman, a journalist, to try and inform what I have done as a journalist. Now, the way I got to The New Yorker was a little circuitous because Calvin Trillin, who appears in The Matter of Black Lives in his wonderful way of reporting, had also come to cover the desegregation of the University of Georgia in 1961, when Hamilton Holmes and I were entering as the first two Black students. And as you know, we were greeted with a lot of the N-word, go home, and riotous mobs that rioted outside my dorm. And I guess it was just the instinct that I had about what I wanted to do with my life, not to be a civil rights pioneer, but to be a journalist. So even with all of that going on, I spent my time in part watching the reporters watch me. And one of my favorite ones somehow was Calvin Trillin, who just always seemed to be there. And he was always smiling, whereas many of them were just looked like they were trying to figure out what they should do about all of this. Right. And so we got to the
era, there was that generic look of needing more fiber in your diet.
Yeah, right. And I remember the night that there had been a riot outside my dorm. They had put me on the first floor. There were no other students down there. All the other girls were upstairs and they used to beat on the ceiling to make me uncomfortable, but they didn't realize I was listening to Nina Simone. So that didn't bother me. And then a rock came through my window. And I think that was supposed to frighten me. But, you know, in those days, we'd all been brought up in the church and brought up to look our best. Even those who were demonstrating in Atlanta against against segregation used to wear their high heel shoes and their gloves and look really nice. So when the rock came through my window, I hadn't unpacked. And all those shards of glass spread out all over my suitcase. And the only thing I could think of wasn't, they're after me, they're going to hurt me, they're going to kill me, was there's glass all over my clothes. And then not long after that, the phone rang. And it was the house mother who lived across the hall from me. She was the only other person on that floor. She came and she said, you have a call. So I go in the hall and it's Calvin Trillin, who at that point was known as Bud. And he said, hey, Charlene, it's Calvin Trillin. I said, yes. And I thought he wanted to know how I was feeling about what was going on. So I'm getting ready to answer the question as best I could. But he said, how'd you like a hot pastrami sandwich right about now? So, you know, it just taught me something. It taught me something. And so subsequently, when everything died down and Bud went back to New York, I got a call saying that William Shawn from The New Yorker was interested in talking to me. He understood I wanted to be a journalist. And would I come to New York and be interviewed? Now, I knew The New Yorker via J.D. Salinger, who was one of my favorites at the time. So I went and I let Bud know. And, you know, Mr. Shawn talked to me about my ambitions. And he said, well, you know, we'd like you to come to The New Yorker if you're interested. He said, just about everybody who comes at your level is an editorial assistant, and that's what you would be to start. And that was just so exciting to me. I mean, there were students there from Bryn Mawr and Vassar and Yale, you know, all these places. And here I am, University of Georgia. Nobody ever heard of it until I got ready to go there. And so I got there and I used to watch what everybody was doing. I was sending out rejection slips and typing. You typed on a typewriter in those days, typing rejection slips and things like that. And the guy sitting across from me was writing poetry, and everybody was doing something that would get them out of that position. And I didn't even think about that for a while until one night I was in Brooklyn, where I was living at the time, and there was a riot going on. And again, it was people protesting inequality. I mean, this is nothing new, what we're having today. This has been going on for a long time. But in those days, this was, I guess, 1963, 64, maybe. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so that was all over the news, three channels at that time. And it was loud and crazy. But the next day, I was going back to work at The New Yorker, and I walked through this neighborhood, and it was silent. There was no sign that anything had taken place the night before. And I guess you could say in a way, well, no, we won't say that's how racism lives. But at any rate, it was very quiet. And so I got on the subway. It was a 45-minute ride into 43rd Street, where The New Yorker was at the time. And I just started writing what it was like to go through that silent space that the night before had been so crazy. Mm-hmm. And I just slipped it under Mr. Shawn's desk door. And the next thing I knew, it was being published in the magazine. That was my very first piece. It was a little while later before I ever got on the staff, but I subsequently was encouraged by the fact that everybody was writing memoirs. So I wrote a memoir. And by this time, Bud Trillin had been hired at The New Yorker, because he wrote a three-part piece about desegregation at UGA and in the South. So I sent it down to him because I hadn't heard back from Mr. Shawn. And he came up to my desk and he said, well, it was called 115th Between Linnets and Fifth. And it was about coming to Harlem as a child with my grandmother and playing in the street with the Spanish kids and learning how they do things and how they speak. And he said, well, I think that if you're going to write about Harlem, you need to write about all the troubles up there and all the problems that people are having. And I'm thinking, oh my God, how I've embarrassed myself by submitting something like this to Mr. Shawn. So before I could cry after Bud left, because I was on the verge of tears, the phone rang and it was Mr. Shawn. And he said, he always called me Miss Hunter. He was very formal, always. And he said, this is Mr. Sean. And I said, and I'm waiting for him to say, how could you have been so stupid to submit something like this to this? He said, well, I've read 115th between Lennox and Fifth. And something in my gut told me that if he used the title, something good was about to happen. Mm-hmm. So I sat up and I said, yes, sir. He said, and we'd like to publish it in the magazine if it's all right with you. I didn't quite know what to say, but I said, of course, Mr. Sean, that's wonderful. Thank you very much. And I'm on the phone and I call Bud and I said, hey, Bud, guess what? You were wrong. Anyway, that's how it started.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's interesting, you know, because, you know, the work that, you know, that you've done, you know, really, so I think about this collection, you know, while we were trying to figure out what it would be, you know, and, you know, David Remnick and I, you know, co-edited it, and we would get on the phone on Tuesday nights at 9 p.m. And just start talking about the piece, but read through the weekend, you know, read on Monday, and then on Tuesday we would hop on the phone and just talk through what we'd read. And at first it was kind of slow going because I didn't really understand, like, well, you know, what would this look like and what would it be? And then I thought, like, what if we just had all of this work in dialogue with what James Baldwin was talking about? And that made it, you know, much more, I think, straightforward, much more direct, in terms of, you know, what we wanted to keep in, you know, the often excruciating process of what we had to cut out and so on. But I think I could say the same thing about you and your early work, you know, there too, and kind of laying down the benchmark for what, you know, writing, particularly writing on subjects of race in The New Yorker, might look like. And then, you know, after you, of course, came Jervis Anderson, and, you know, Jamaica Kincaid and Henry Louis Gates and Toni Morrison and a whole array of voices, you know, to, you know, the group of people who we, you know, regularly see in the New Yorker's pages. And so I think so much of that is attributable to you and the work that you did then.
Well, I think that what's important to appreciate about Mr. Sean and the New Yorker and all of the pieces that are included in this wonderful book. When I went there, I was promoted to Talk of the Town not too long after I ran the three pieces, the memoir and then the second memoir and the comment piece. But in those days, Talk of the Town was very limited. I mean, you could get maybe three pieces or four pieces, but they had to be the top pieces. So I sat there and I figured, how do I get my pieces in when I have so much competition? But then I looked and there was really nobody writing about Harlem in the way that I saw Harlem, which was its people and in all of their manifestations, but primarily in their positive manifestations. Mm-hmm. And so I began writing pieces about Harlem and Bedford-Stuyvesant and in a way that they hadn't really been done before. It hadn't been done before. And so I was getting in the magazine on a regular basis. But I also have to say that while I think that was very important, not because I was doing it, but because this was unusual, an unusual way to write about Black people. I didn't write just about Black people, but that was a part of large part of what I wrote about. But I think the thing about the book is that it gives us such a perspective on our journey. I guess I should quote maybe Zora Neale Hurston, our journey to the horizons or wherever we're going, because when I have gone back over the book, and I have many times, because it takes a while to, you know, absorb all of what's in there.
848 pages.
How many?
848.
Right. And I'm still processing some of those pages. But I think that as we have the conversation today about race and, dare I say, critical race theory, I don't want to be controversial, but what I want to say is that it reminds me again, when I was at the University of Georgia in those early days, and I had a professor in the journalism college who on the first day in his class, he said, "We learn from history that we do not learn from history." Mm. And I didn't use bad words in those days, but today I would have said, "What the F is he talking about?" I didn't use those terms in those days. I said, "What does that mean?"
Important emphasis on those days.
right. But I think that what this book, The Matter of Black Lives, is really all about is helping everybody who delves into it. It's 800 and some pages. Over time, because it takes time to go through, I underline, I turn, nobody will ever get this book as a gift because I've written in it, I've turned down pages and everything. But it tells us that we must learn from history. And it gives the kind of history in a way that I think people should be receptive to. I mean, I sent you today as you were traveling to get to wherever it is you are, I forgot. But there was something that Baldwin had said that I thought I wrote it down talking about.
I have it if you want me to read it.
Yeah, read it because I forgot. I have it written down, but I can't read my writing.
You said that it reminded you of George Floyd. You say on page 59 where he says he was speaking to. The beginning of the quote is here, relatively conscious whites and relatively conscious blacks who must, like lovers, insist on or create the consciousness of others. They do not falter in our duty now. We may be able, handful that we are, to end the racial nightmare and achieve our country and change our history and the world. And if not, God gave Noah the rainbow sign of no more water, the fire next time.
You see, is that relevant to this moment when, you know, you heard at the beginning of the program, you heard Miranda say, we're so divided. And I forget exactly what she said, but she talked about these divisive times or something to that effect. Mm-hmm. Forgive me if I misquoted you, Miranda. But here is somebody all those years ago. What year was that, Jelani?
1962.
1962, where he is talking about the importance of Black people and white people coming together and bridging the gaps that exist. And when we hear today, we hear generalizations about white people. We hear generalizations about Black people. And I hear myself saying, but wait a minute, let's don't generalize. I'm not sure that's helping the situation. Let's give some history to this, because white people did in fact come with us in some very important times, including when I was at UGA. There were students who reached out to me. There were students and people who reached out and died for us, Goodman and Schwerner, who went to the South in the civil rights movement and were murdered because they were, and Viola Liozzo, who marched for us. So while we as a people are the objects of racism, all kinds of people, and this is what I think Baldwin was talking about. If we're going to bridge these racial divisions and gaps, we have to work together and be prepared to try and move forward. Do you think that's true?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is, but I also think that it's obviously easier said than done, you know, and because Baldwin also talked about race being a nation in a way. And so, you know, one of the things I like, you know, the quotes I like from Baldwin the most is when he said that the world is held together by the love of a shockingly few number of people, a shockingly small number of people. And right. So I think it's that, you know, is that kind of that dynamic. And we're also in effect talking about democracy, you know, the ability to recognize the humanity of your fellow human being, your fellow counterpart. Right. So, I think that's really interesting. And, you know, for him to have thrown down this gambit, you know, really in The New Yorker in 1962 is even more astounding. You know, the backstory of that essay, which, you know, I talk about a little bit in the introduction, is even as interesting as the essay itself, which is that, you know, Baldwin had visited, I think it was 4 or 5 countries in Africa. And he was, you know, like most freelancers, juggling multiple assignments at the time. And so he had an assignment for Commentary to write a piece about Harlem. He had an assignment from William Shawn to write a piece about Africa, as in a Black American going to the recently decolonized nations in Africa on the African continent. And so he traveled around, and the experience left him cold, really. You know, he had these observations, but he didn't have the kind of personal revelation that writing comes from. In fact, his experience on the African continent made him more interested in writing about Harlem. And so he writes this titanic essay, and instead of giving it to Commentary, which had commissioned it in the first place, he gave it to The New Yorker, likely because The New Yorker paid better.
Well, that's important.
That's important. It's very real. And I always like, when I think about that piece, I think about, you know, what the, you know, poor innocent reader of The New Yorker must have experienced, you know, making the trip to the mailbox, you know, or going to the mail slot or whatever, and expecting the same sort of, you know, thoughtful examinations of the world around you, but not anything that has the kind of personal indictment of, you know, circumstances that have affected every single person in this country that Baldwin put together. And it's kind of like, what was the reaction to seeing that? And so the other thing that I think is interesting in terms of thinking about the work that's in dialogue, you know, we have, you know, the Zadie Smith essay that is in here about Key and Peele, you know, the Toni Morrison essays, you know, essay on the after the election of Donald Trump. Lewis.
Oh, that was a hard one. That was cold.
Yeah. Skip Gates' examination of Louis Farrakhan in the aftermath of the Million Man March.
Right.
One of my favorites is Calvin Trillin's Letter from Jackson, which is just a golden opportunity for a journalist. He is on an airplane that Martin Luther King and several of his lieutenants are also on, and he's close enough to overhear a conversation that King is having with a racist passenger on the plane. If you wrote this as a play, people would say it was too heavy-handed, you know, because there's the metaphor of the plane. People are literally moving in the same direction together, but separated, you know, by an aisle. You know, King is on one side, this white man is on the other side. Their ability to get to this other place is bound together. They will only get there at the same time. And so he's there and able to just kind of observe this and write about, you know, what he sees in that moment. And just think, you know, there's no better experience for a journalist than to have that, you know, situation fall upon you.
Well, he was a great role model for me and a great friend and continues to be. But Jelani, I want to say how important your writing is also, because in your introduction, again, thinking about my college professor saying we learn from history that we do not learn from history. I mean, you talked about, you referred to the metaphor, stacked inequities of the society that produced them. Mm-hmm. And we have this discussion going on. Here's where so much of that history that's contained in the book looks at, can look at things that we're experiencing today, because there's this argument about critical race theory, which is not taught in either elementary school or high school or even college. It's taught in law school, which people don't seem to get. But critical race theory really does look at what you referred to, which is stacked inequities that have gone on for generations. So that if you look at COVID, if you look at unemployment, if mm-hmm. you look at all of the things that this latest project of the current government has undertaken mm-hmm. To try to equalize the society, who is having the most serious, deleterious effect from COVID? Black people. Who is suffering the most from unemployment? Black people. Who is the most, who do we have in the prisons the most? Black men and women now. There are more Black women in prison today, I think. I could be wrong, you know the history of this probably. But I think there are more Black women in prison today than Black men. But the inequities, the stacked inequities of the society all fall within the people that you have written about or have been written about in this book. And the book goes way back. And look where we are today, wrestling with some of the same issues, similar issues.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that was a little striking to me, a little notable to me, was it actually goes back to the first time you and I met, which, you know, we met under terrible circumstances, but on television together in the aftermath of the mass shooting at the Emmanuel AME Church.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. The death of, you know, 9 Black parishioners, the congregants, at the hands of a white supremacist, 21-year-old white supremacist. And you know, we were on television discussing this. I was there to cover, you know, what happened. And I later came back and covered the trial of the murderer. And, you know, in the course of covering that trial, you know, there's two really notable things that happened. You know, the first was that I was looking back at, you know, the last lynching. I was trying to find the last recorded lynching in South Carolina history. And it was happened in 1947. And, you know, unbeknownst to me at the time, you know, Rebecca West had written that really long piece about that lynching, mm-hmm. and about the reaction that the state of South Carolina had, that the governor, who at the time was Strom Thurmond, mm-hmm. Recognized, and this was a kind of moment, you know, landmark shift, you know, watershed moment, that, you know, he recognized that mass killings of the sort that had been perpetrated in Greenville at this time looked bad, and that they would have a negative economic impact on the state.
Right.
Not the humanitarian idea.
Right.
That people would judge them and they would think they were savages and it would impede their economic development. And so it's for that reason they have a trial, which they would typically would not have had. Everyone is acquitted, you know, it's kind of a done deal from the get-go. But, you know, Rebecca West wrote that really incisive examination of how that happened, you know, of how that trial took place and why it took place. And here I was across the span of decades writing about the death of 9 Black parishioners, congregants, mm-hmm. and the decision to take down the Confederate flag flying over the state capitol for reasons that exactly mirrored what Strom Thurmond had been talking about in 1947. Mm-hmm. And so that was a kind of interesting parallel, you know, with, you know, writing on this subject across, you know, very many years. The other thing that was interesting about it was that when you know, after the trial ended, you know, and I flew, interestingly enough, to San Francisco, where I am now, I just happened to have an engagement that, you know, happened that day. And I flew out. It was an extremely emotionally taxing experience. And, you know, I got on the earliest flight out of Charleston they had, flew to, and it was like 5:30 in the morning, flew to LaGuardia in New York City, then took a taxi from LaGuardia to JFK, got on a flight to San Francisco. And when I landed in San Francisco, one, you know, I'd been on airplanes all day, but when I landed in San Francisco, it occurred to me that I had not spoken to another human being all day. Mm. And just to kind of break the silence, I strike up, you know, small talk. I make small talk with the bellman at the hotel where I was staying. And, you know, I said, oh, are you a native, you know, San Franciscan? You know, what, did you migrate here? He said, well, I've been here for 8 years, but I'm originally from Charleston, South Carolina.
Ooh.
And I said, oh, it's interesting. That's where I'm coming from. I should back up and tell you something. One of the last things that was said to me before I left South Carolina was from Malcolm Graham, who was the brother of one of the victims, a woman by the name of Cynthia Graham Hurd, who was a librarian. You know, he said to me, I'm going to spend the rest of my life making sure the world knows who my sister was. And so that was one of the last conversations I had in Charleston, you know, before I flew out. And so the next day, the next evening, actually, where I'm in San Francisco, and I mentioned to this bellman that I had been in Charleston, he wanted to know why I was there. I said I was there to cover the trial of Dylann Roof. And he said, he just had this stricken look on his face. He said, that man took away someone very important from me. And I said, who? He said, my childhood librarian. Her name was Cynthia Graham Hurd.
Mm.
And I just stopped. It just stopped me cold. And that's the conclusion for that piece. That's the conclusion that, you know, how that piece ends. Mm-hmm. That, you know, I started the morning in the farthest part of the East Coast. You know, Charleston is a port city. And I ended the day on the West Coast in another port city. You know, I was blocks away from the Atlantic, and now I was blocks away from the Pacific. And so it was a metaphor about the problem of race stretching to the exact parameters of the entire country.
Right. Yeah. You might have had tears in your eyes at that point. I don't know. I'm not going to ask. I don't know if you get emotional. But you see, that again is why this book is so important, and a program like this is so important, because it underscores, I think, the importance of learning from history. Because a few years ago, well, maybe just 2 or 3 years ago, well, before COVID, I went to the Southern Poverty Law Center, because I do a series for the NewsHour on looking at solutions to racism. And one of the people I interviewed there was telling me about the lack of Black history being taught in schools. They had looked at schools all over the country, and 85%, this was just 3 or 4 years ago, 85% of the schools in this country did not have classes in Black history. And so when you have these divisions like we have today, it is in part because our history is not being taught. And while a lot of the pieces in this book are very difficult, because they're about difficult events that happened, these are things that our people, and I'm talking about all of our people, Black and white and Latin and gay and straight, and all of our people who call themselves Americans, need to know. And I'm just nervous and afraid that, I mean, I'm I'm participating with you because I love you and I love the New Yorker and everybody involved there. But I'm also participating because I'm hoping that it will stimulate people to share this book with people who are ignorant of our history. Mm. Because if they read this history, I think it will help bridge some gaps. And it's so important right now when there's so much debate, that's almost too kind a word, but so much unpleasantness, that's also too kind, about our history. Mm-hmm. I think of our history, and I've said this many times, so it's beginning to sound like one of my cliches, but our history, our Black history, is my armor. That is what enabled me to walk through mobs who were threatening to kill me and not be afraid, because I was wearing the armor of the history of people who had been up against things a lot worse than me, and they survived. And we were taught about these people in our schools, because when our Black teachers and parents and neighbors couldn't give us first-class citizenship because we lived at that time in the lie of separate but equal. So we used to get the textbooks, hand-me-down textbooks from the white schools that had pages missing. But somehow our teachers and our preachers, like those at the AME Church in Charlottesville, they taught us the history of our people and how we survived. Our people survived some of the worst things that you can imagine, the lynchings and I don't want to get into, but you know what it is that we have survived going back to the 1500s when we first got here to this country. And so when I was taught that, and my classmates were taught that history, it was armor. It helped protect us from anything that we confronted that had to do with the color of our skin. And so if people can take this book that you've put together with David Remnick, one of my dear friends, and David, would you please publish the next thing I send to the New Yorker? Okay, I've got my point in it. But anyway, I had to do that. I hope he's listening. I don't have anything right now. But if people who are so divided can take this book and read what has gone on throughout the years with Black people and the attitudes, even when some of them are negative on white people, a negative period, I think that it will make a difference in the lives of some people. Because I don't think, and I guess this goes back to my AME church bearing, being brought up, I don't think people are basically evil. And they're just misinformed. And this book is something that I think will help inform people if we can figure out how to get it into the hands of people who need it. And we all need it, even people like myself. Because going back over it in the last few days, getting ready to talk to you tonight, I went back through some of those pieces that I hadn't read at the time. And they're informative. They tell you things you need to know about this country. And I think we all need to see, I mean, I don't know how much it costs because y'all sent me a free one, but but it would be great, a great present for people's birthdays. It would be a great present for Christmas. It would be a great present for Hanukkah, which is coming up. People need what's in this book, even though sometimes it's a little hard to digest, but that's life.
Yeah, I agree. I think, and I thank you for eloquently framing that. You know, actually, and per our typical way of doing things, this is like time. You know, time has flown. We have, you know, questions that we're supposed to address. One is from Helen. She wants to know, would that piece of Baldwin's be received any differently were it published today?
Would we see it differently?
You would that Baldwin piece be received differently if it were published today?
Well, I don't know how it was received when it was published. I mean, the people who read the New Yorker read it and liked it, I guess.
Yeah, that's
I don't know what the larger community felt about it. What do you?
Now I want to go back to the New Yorker archives and see what the letters were the week after that. You know,
yeah.
Which I should have done actually before. So, you know.
But did they keep them? Did they keep those letters?
I don't know, but they probably printed some in the subsequent issues. You know, so now Helen has given me a, you know, homework assignment.
Right.
But I think that it would be received differently now because the context is different. Meaning that, you know, Baldwin was really risking his neck and risking his career, you know, by writing this in 1962. You know, now there's just a multiplicity of voices, you know, that are able to, you know, articulate these ideas. I think it would be an amazing piece of writing because that's why we still go back to it, you know, the caliber and the quality of the writing. But I don't think people would be shocked to see something like this in print in the way that they were in 1962, not in a mainstream publication.
Yeah, because what's happening today, I think it's a positive development, although it can get a little complicated sometimes and confusing. But we've entered a period now where there's more openness towards what is called diversity and inclusion. Mm-hmm. And so we're seeing more people of color, Black people, Asian people, gay people, straight people, trans people, having their say in print everywhere, not just in, you know, special magazines, but all over the place and in op-ed and so forth and so on. So it's getting out there. It's just a question of how do we get the people, or all people, on the same page? Now that may be more of a desire that arises out of my upbringing in as a PK. Mm-hmm. And maybe we won't ever get people all on the same page, but maybe we can tone down the awful discussion that's going on that goes on over here and over here, but never in the middle. I mean, for example, as you know, I work for the NewsHour from time to time, and I really do enjoy listening to the conversation between the people who they bring on to talk about two different to talk about what's going on in the world, in the country. And sometimes they agree and sometimes they don't, but when they don't, they do it politely, you know, and I think that's really important, to do, to see how we can disagree without being disagreeable.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. So there's a question, that I think is interesting. I get this question a lot, so I'm going to ask you to answer it. Do you feel hopeful about the future?
Of course I do. I mean, look at you. We got you and David Remnick putting together this book and all the people who've written about it. But we also, you know, again, I come out of the civil rights movement, although I don't consider myself an activist. But I learned from the people in the movement that you, including and especially Martin Luther King, who talked about keeping hope alive. And although there are things going on in this country now that are extremely disturbing, if we give up hope, we give up on our country. But we not only give up on our country, we give up on the world. Because the goal, the lessons that our Constitution contained have been inspirations to people all over the world. I mean, I've covered Africa from one end to the other, and from the 80s when there was apartheid, and I went to Uganda when you know, there was an Ebola outbreak. I was all over. And everywhere I ever went, people looked to this country mm-hmm. as a guiding post. Mm-hmm. And we can't, I have the hope that what it was that caused those people to look to us will continue. And I do think that there are people out there who will help do that. You can't give up hope.
There's one question that I think is important, and maybe we can close with this one. What advice would you give young Black writers working toward careers as journalists and essayists today?
Well, I think you should answer that too. But I think that you have to follow your heart. I mean, I remember, again, quoting Zora Neale Hurston about going on my journey to the horizons mm-hmm. and not letting anything get in the way of that. And sometimes your role will be to talk about your people in ways that are not being done enough, mm-hmm. but also to follow your instincts about where you do best. You know, it could be covering the weather. It could be covering football. It could be covering the news. And let me just say this. I hope that some of our young people, both Black and white, will somehow insist. I don't know how they're going to do it, because it's going to cost money and it's going to need a lot of energy. We cannot let our local newspapers die. And that is happening. And that is another reason that we have so much division. We don't have enough information getting out where people live. People are depending on, depending on social media. And if we get good local news papers and good journalism at the local level, I think it's going to help save our democracy.
Mm. I would advise, for young Black writers and essayists and journalists, a lot of what I advise young writers in general, which is that, to read voraciously and read widely, expose yourself to as many different varieties of information and vantage points as possible, because that all kind of serves the form of mental archive that helps you start your work, irrespective of what it is that you're covering or what it is that you're writing about. Mm-hmm. It gives you a baseline that you start from. I think that that's really important. One of the things that I tell essayists all the time is to study other forms of writing. August Wilson started out with poetry, and he wasn't great as a poet. but what poetry did was give him a sense of rhythm in his playwriting and a kind of sense of, how a sentence works. And it refined his ear in particular ways. Take a fiction writing class, take a poetry, class, other genres, music, film, they all have things that can be instructive to you, particularly as people who are essayists, for the form, and then read everyone, everyone who has practiced, the form. I have a shelf, a part of my bookshelf, which is nothing but essay collections. And so, that's important, for specifically Black writers, and also, for women writers and for Black women writers, I say that you need a thick skin. There's a lot of rejection in this arena for anyone. And then there's a disproportionate amount of rejection for, particular communities, which still are not represented, in the way that we should be in the media landscape. So all those things, and, keep at it, write and read and write and read, when things are going well, when things are difficult, when it's raining outside, when it's beautiful outside, and all those things, keep going, keep doing those things.
And can I just add one thing? That was, I'm not surprised, it was brilliant, Jelani, as you often are, but don't be afraid to speak up and speak truth to power.
Mm-hmm.
And try to be on the right side, but and do your homework, but don't take you know what. Starts with an S and ends with a T. No, really, let me be a little more gracious about it, because you're going to be tested. You're going to be challenged, and just have your thing together and don't be afraid ever to take a position once you have determined that you are right. It's going to happen. And even though we have an expansive expansion now in terms of hiring more people of color, I don't know if that's going to continue. But while you're there, don't be afraid. Speak truth to power and have it together. Have your facts together and don't ever be afraid to speak truth to power.
I think that's the note that we have to conclude on, which I think is a great note. And, you know, we will invite Jessica back. I'm thankful that I got a chance to talk with you, you know, often under, you know, before the pandemic, you know, these conversations would take place on your porch in Martha's Vineyard.
Right. And I have a great picture of you and me on our Facebook page with Ta-Nehisi Coates. Okay. And you haven't seen it yet.
Forgotten about that picture. Yeah, you sent it to me. I'd forgotten about it.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, in lieu of that, I'm glad that we were able to have this discussion tonight.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you
both for this wonderful conversation. And I think everyone should read and think and run out and get The Matter of Black Lives, which is terrific. And thank you both. You've given me a lot of hope about this country, hearing both of you speak. So thank you. I'm really grateful that you're both here. And thank you all for being here this evening. We will have our next program is Louise Edridge, and I hope you'll be there. Thank you.
Yeah, I love her work.
thank you. Be safe. Stay safe.
Thank you so much.
Aloud is made possible by the Hearst Foundation, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, the Los Angeles County Department of Arts and Culture, Errant Fox, City National Bank, the Los Angeles Public Library, and additional generous supporters of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. To support programs like this, become a member at lfla.org.